It's about time for us to start. I hope everyone has one of these handouts. It's an interesting puzzle that you'll see on the handout. I'm going to explain it to you in today's lesson. On the schedule, you have a lesson today about Ezekiel, and we'll get to that in a few minutes. You're going to get two for the price of one this morning. We're going to look at something left over from the Temple of Solomon, and then we'll get to Ezekiel. We'll whittle Ezekiel down a little bit so we'll have room for both of them this morning. But I wanted to tell you something that I think is important to a lot of people who look at the Bible, particularly the Old Testament, as being mostly mythology. But the Old Testament is really accurate history, and we know that, but people don't believe it. And they say, well, give us some real evidence, and that's what we're going to talk about first of all today. And an interesting pun, I'll tell you it's a pun to start with. I've always been interested in archaeology. And so you know that we had a series of lessons about Noah's Ark and the remnants of that, and also about the Ark of the Covenant. Two different arcs for archaeology to look at. The Ark of the Covenant, you'll see stuff on TV from time to time about searching for the lost ark. Have you? I guess the popularity for that came from the series of movies, or from the movie in the series about searching for the lost ark. And so there have been people looking for that, and stories about perhaps it still exists somewhere in Ethiopia or someplace like that. But we're going to see what happened to the ark. I want to spend a few minutes looking at that, because that was the purpose of building the temple, to bring the Ark of the Covenant into Jerusalem and put it in a permanent home. And that's the vision that David had, and that's what Solomon was dedicated to doing. So they built this structure, and then they brought the ark into the temple. And there are several interesting things that happen in the process, and we want to look at that first this morning. King Solomon summoned into his presence at Jerusalem the elders of Israel, all the heads of the tribes, chiefs of the Israelite families, to bring up the Ark of the Lord's Covenant from Zion, the city of David. Now, where is Zion? Zion's actually just further down the hill from the top of Mount Moriah, where the temple has been built. And so the city of David was where David first resided when they captured Jerusalem. Now, that the city of David was where David lived, of course. And Solomon, when he became king, in conjunction with building the temple, he also built his palace further up the hill, a magnificent place, and we'll talk about that someday, but not today. So this is an important event, isn't it? He brings all of the heads of his government together, and all the men of Israel came together to King Solomon at the time of the festival in the month of Ethanim, the seventh month. When all the elders of Israel had arrived, the priests took up the ark, and they brought up the ark of the Lord and the tent of meeting and all the sacred furnishings in it. So there's the end of the tabernacle. You won't read any more about the tabernacle as such. That's the tent of meeting that they brought up. Now, there was also a tent that David had put the ark in, but that's not what this word means. This is the tabernacle that's brought up to the temple, and you don't read about it anymore. The assumption is they folded it all up and put it in one of the storerooms. So all of the sacred furnishings in it has to do, of course, with the tabernacle itself. What are we talking about there? Well, the lampstand, the table on which the showbread was kept, and the altar of incense. Those were the main things, plus all of the implements that went with those particular items. And of course, many of them were, all of them were made of gold, and some things made of silver, apparently. And that material is at this point about 500 years old. Do you have any artifacts in your house that are 500 years old? That qualifies as being antique, doesn't it? Many times over. And so they've kept all of that material to this point. The priests and the Levites carried them up. And of course, we read early on in our study about how only certain men were qualified to carry these various implements and as they moved the tabernacle from place to place. So, the priests and the Levites carry them up, and King Solomon and with him the entire assembly of Israel that had gathered about him were before the ark. Here we have a celebration and a parade just like the one that David had when he brought the ark into Jerusalem years before. And so they were sacrificing so many sheep and cattle that they could not be recorded or counted. The priest then brought the Ark of the Lord's Covenant to the place, to its place in the inner sanctuary of the temple, the most holy place, and put it beneath the wings of the cherubim. The cherubim spread their wings over the place of the Ark and overshadowed the Ark and its carrying poles. And we've mentioned this before, the poles were so long that their ends could be seen from the holy place in front of the inner sanctuary, but not from outside the holy place. And they are still there today. Now, when is today in this situation? Well, that's toward the end of the history of the temple. The men who were writing 2 Kings were recording this, and at that time, just before the destruction of it, those poles were still in place. And that had been the requirement, that the poles never be removed, you might remember. But the interesting thing is how long they were. And they were pointed toward the door to the most holy place. And so if they were approximately 20 cubits or 37 feet long, those were long poles. And why were they so long? Because the men who were carrying the ark were afraid of the ark. And I think that is most interesting, that they got as far away from it and still, if the poles had been any longer, they'd had trouble lifting the poles. You realize that. So that's really quite remarkable. But anyway, I want to go back to the phrases in the first part of this. Let's finish up the paragraph. There was nothing in the ark except the two stone tablets that Moses had placed in it at Horeb, where the Lord made a covenant with the Israelites after they came out of Egypt. And it's a puzzle to me how anybody knew what was in the ark, because anybody that opened it up and looked in it, what happened? They died. Now, maybe there was some information about what was in it when it was brought back from the Philistines, but it's curious, maybe this just revelation from God, that that's all that was left. There wasn't anything else in it but the two stone tablets. Now, I want you to note these two phrases up that I've turned red here. The ark had its place in the inner sanctuary of the temple, that is the most holy place. And the cherubim spread their wings over the place of the ark and overshadowed the ark and its carrying poles. What is the place of the ark? And that's what you read through that and you say, well, it's just a spot where they intended to set it. But it seems that before they started construction of the temple, they calculated where they would put the Ark of the Covenant and prepared a spot in the rock. Now, we need to talk about this rock that the temple was built over. David had said, you'll put the temple here. And it was the threshing floor of Araunah. Remember that back from the last chapter of 2 Samuel. So there was a specific rock at the top of the mountain, apparently, an outcropping that was fairly flat. To be a threshing floor, the oxen had to be able to run in a circle to thresh the wheat, and so it was a flat rock on the top of the mountain. And so I've given you the handout which shows you this rock. We know where that rock is, and it's it has an interesting history in that it here's the spot where they put the Ark of the Covenant on that rock underneath the wings of the cherubim. This is someone's idea of what the cherubim and their spread wings looked like. And it would be in the dead center of the most holy place, 10 cubits from each wall. But it sits directly on the rock. It doesn't sit on a table or anything like it does in some illustrations that you'll see. It sits endways, its long axis running along the axis of the temple. And so the only thing that Solomon did to that rock, apparently he didn't cover it with anything except he covered it with gold. He put a layer of gold over the rock. That rock sits under a building in Jerusalem today. It was sheltered under the Temple of Solomon. That temple was destroyed, but a century later, the returning Jews built another temple on the same footprint, and that one may also have been torn down and rebuilt a couple of times before Herod built his temple on that same site, and that temple was destroyed in AD 70. The site sat exposed to the weather for a little while, maybe a century back before the returning exiles rebuilt the temple, and it sat for another 50 or 100 years until the Byzantine Empire built a church over this site, and that lasted several centuries until the Arabs captured it all, and they built a building called the Dome of the Rock. It was reconstructed once, a few decades after it was first built, but this is a very ancient building. And it shelters this same rock from the weather. So the changes that were made to the rock have been protected. They're not worn away by the storms and water and all that sort of thing. And so we can still see the scars on the surface of the rock, which came from the modifications that were made in the various constructions. Now, this building is open to visitors. It's called the Dome of the Rock. It sits on what's called the Temple Mount. And, of course, it's that because that's where Solomon's temple was. And everyone has known all along that the rock, which was the threshing floor of Aruna, is underneath that dome. Now, you can go visit that and tour, and the top picture in your handout, Es Sacra, shows a group of tourists in the lower right-hand corner, those little spots down there, looking out over the rock. And you can see them here. Nope, it's not covered with gold anymore. You can imagine that the people who destroyed it, Solomon's temple, carried away all the gold they could scrape off the ground. And so it's a rock that has a color to it, but it isn't gold anymore. Now it's been whittled away some. Particularly in the upper left corner up there. And that story goes to the time of the Crusaders when they came through and there was a church over the site at the time, which they took over. No, there was the Dome of the Rock over the site, the mosque over the site. And so when they had control of it, they mined the upper left corner of the rock, cutting off little squares of it and selling them back in Europe for an equivalent weight of gold. So it was a money-making to finance their crusades. It was a money-making project, but they didn't destroy any critical parts of the rock. It's called Es-Sakra. That's the Arabic name of it. It is considered holy to the Arabs, and you might wonder why, but it was the site from which Muhammad ascended to heaven, in their view of the story. But because it was also Muhammad's intention to include the Judaic history in the story of Islam, that Abraham and Isaac, or Ishmael, excuse me, and many of the prophets and even Jesus were considered holy to them, and this site where the temple, where Solomon had built the temple, was also holy. So they covered it, and the story is that a young man from Scandinavia, his name was Lien, L-E-E-N, Lien Rittmeyer, you'll see his name down at the in the bottom picture down there, was working on his PhD thesis, and he took as in architecture, and he took as a topic the structure of Solomon's temple. So he went to see this rock, but from where the visitors stand, they're almost at eye level to the top of the rock. The rock stands up out of the dirt at this point, and so when you're looking out across it, your head is a little higher than the rock, but you can't see much of the structure of it. So he got permission for a photographer to go up into the dome of the Dome of the Rock. There's a walkway, a catwalk up there, and to take a photometric camera with him that had specific lenses and exposures and so on, so that with a known distance from the rock from above, he could photograph it, and they could make measurements of the scars on this rock. Now, he noticed in particular where the green arrow is. There's a rectangle here that's a pretty good right angle rectangle, and he wanted to get the dimensions of things like that, because that could be something interesting in the construction of the temple. There was also an area right here which he calculated was actually in the middle of the structure of the Dome of the Rock, and that spot evidently was used to erect some sort of a pole where they built the dome. And so there's also a cave with an opening here, so that you can see down below there a cave underneath the rock, that the tourists get to go down there as well. There are some scars across the rock at this point, passing here, which is apparently where the rock has been smoothed somewhat to lay what looked like to Lien would be foundation stones. And so he developed the picture down below in your handout, and you see it here. Notice that north is off to the left. The picture ought to be presented with north to the top, but the holy place is in the west. The most holy place is in the west end of the temple. This is the holy place, and it extends up toward the ceiling. That ought to go off to the right, because that direction is east. And so all of the temples were laid out exactly that way. And as he was flying into Jerusalem on one of his trips, studying his picture that he had of Es-Sakra here, he noticed that if these scars on the rock over here were actually foundation stones of one of the walls of the temple, then the west wall could lie off the scarf. The rock goes straight down at this point into more bedrock down below, and it's almost a right angle on this side, so you could put the north wall of the temple here. And if you did that, this rectangle is in the dead center of the most holy place. And when the light dawned, he got real excited because that was something nobody else had ever noticed. And that rectangle is kind of interesting in itself. I have turned the thing so that it now faces east in the next picture. And you can see the outline, just simply the outline of the rock itself, and where the center of the dome of the dome of the rock is. Here are the scars where there were foundation stones, apparently, running across the rock. Now, the rock's so big that even though it's 20 cubits from here to here, you can't put the rock in any orientation completely within the temple. You've got to run one wall across the rock. But the other two walls, at the back and at the north side, could easily be off the edge of the rock. And so the place for the ark would be where that rectangle is. Now, how big is that rectangle? And, of course, that's the critical question. We know that the diameter here is 20 cubits. But we don't know exactly how big a cubit is, and we'll talk a little bit more about that when we talk about Ezekiel here in a minute. You can see how that fits into Solomon's temple. We've looked at this floor plan several times. And so the sacra is back here. And the place of the ark is underneath, in the dead center of the most holy place, underneath where the wings meet from the two cherubim. Now, as sacra is going to stick out, if this is the wall that runs across the rock here, it sticks out some distance, but it doesn't come outside the temple because of these side rooms that were added or that were placed on the north and south sides of the temple. There we go. So let's do some calculations. And this, if it turns out that that's the place where they put the Ark of the Covenant, then this is archaeology at its best because it has mathematics behind it, as you'll see. Now men have argued that Solomon's temple was just a myth, but if that turns out to be right, the Ark of the Covenant was 1.5 cubits wide and 2.5 cubits long. The length to width ratio is 1.67. It doesn't matter what the length of a cubit is because both measurements are in cubits. The rectangular depression is 31 inches wide and 52 inches long. Now, it could have been anything, but if it's a spot where they set the ark, it's got to be the dimensions of the ark itself. And the length to width ratio is 1.68. That's well within the error of the photometric system for determining the length and width. 31 and 52 inches is as close as they could get to an accurate measurement. It might be 31.25 and 52.6 or something. But you see, it is the dimension, the length to width ratios do fit a structure like the Ark of the Covenant. And so, if 31 inches is 1.5 cubits, then a cubit is 20.7 inches. If 52 inches is 2.5 cubits, then one cubit is 20.8 inches. You're going to set the ark down in this little depression that goes about 1.5 to 2 inches down into the rock. And so it has to, the opening for setting it down has to be slightly bigger than the Ark of the Covenant itself. And why would they do that? Why would they make this little hollowed out place in the rock? Well, first of all, the rock isn't perfectly flat. And the other thing is that they have earthquakes in that region. They're sitting right on a major fault that runs all the way from Africa up into the Middle East. And so they have earthquakes. You read about earthquakes in the Bible. So if they have an earthquake and this thing is sitting on top of the rock and it isn't exactly flat, you can imagine it would skitter around on the rock and it might be thrown into something, to a wall or something, and destroyed. So they fastened it without actually let gravity hold it in this place by making a little hollowed out place and setting it down in it. The place in the rock must be slightly larger than the ark. And so these are acceptable values. And that's where I've been telling you that the cubit which they were using, that Moses used, the cubit that Solomon used, and he says it's the cubit by the old standard, is this value, 20.6. It could be 20.5. It could be 20.7. We don't know if, I mean, a tenth, what's a tenth of an inch among friends? We don't really care. But if that's the case, then you can look at the distance between the walls. Does that calculate out properly to 37 point something feet? And it does. And the wall thickness then would be 6 cubits, and that turns out to be slightly over 10 feet in the thickness of the wall. Now, we'll see that again in a minute when we talk about Ezekiel. Okay, so there is some real archaeology, some real physical evidence that there was something built on this ark, on this rock, that held the Ark of the Covenant, and it relates to the story of Solomon's temple and the architecture that we've seen for that temple. And I think that is probably the most solid evidence of Solomon's temple. In fact, lots of supposed experts don't believe there's much evidence at all for David or Solomon, either one. After all, that was 1,000 years B.C. They don't expect to find anything. And if you present something like this, see, this is solid, tangible evidence that the temple was built there. Okay. When the priests withdrew from the holy place, the cloud filled the temple of the Lord, and the priests could not perform their service because the cloud, for the glory of the Lord, filled his temple. And this is important. This was God accepting what they had done, wasn't it? Solomon said, and you read this and you think, well, it's sort of self-aggrandizement. He said, "The Lord has said that he would dwell in a dark cloud, and I have indeed built a magnificent temple for you, a place for you to dwell forever." How much of the work do you suppose Solomon did as king? The work was done. The work was done by the workman, wasn't it? But he was in charge. Okay, he's the supervisor and the final authority, and so we'll give it to him. And so there's this magnificent temple for God to dwell in forever. And so did God accept what they had done? And the answer seems to be yes. Now, that statement is followed by most of a chapter in which Solomon had a dedicatory prayer. And when he had finished praying, this is in the next chapter, chapter 7, fire came down from heaven and consumed the burnt offering and the sacrifices, and the glory of the Lord filled the temple. And so the fire for the sacrifices in the altar in front of the temple was a fire that came from heaven. Well, some of us have been talking about the fact that you sacrifice all these cattle and sheep and everything. How do you ever, you can't burn those carcasses up in a reasonable amount of time. But the fire from heaven can consume them. And that happened several times. I'm reminded of the time when Elijah, having his contest with the prophets of Baal, not only did the fire from heaven take Elijah's sacrifice, it destroyed the altar and licked up the water in the... You remember that story? It's pretty powerful fire. I don't know if it's fire like we think of fire, but the fire was never allowed to go out. And the reason, when someone offered strange fire, you see, Nadab and Abihu in a story like that, there's something different about the fire from heaven. But certainly God accepted what Solomon and his workers had done. Okay. Now, fast forward several hundred years, and Israel has fallen into idolatry. And here we have Jeremiah making a prophecy in the third chapter, verses 14 to 17, return faithless people. He's pleading for Israel to come back to the Lord. The temple's been sitting there all this time. It falls into disrepair and various things happen to it. And they renew their faith and then they fall away again. And the Lord says, "For I am your husband. I will choose one of you from every town and two from every clan and bring you to Zion." That's back to Jerusalem. "Then I will give you shepherds after my own heart." He'd been complaining about the fact that the shepherds, the leaders of the people, were not doing their job. "And I will lead you with knowledge and understanding." There's a challenge for the leaders in the church. "In those days when your numbers have increased greatly in the land, declares the Lord, men will no longer say..." Notice what he's talking about here. "Men will no longer say the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. It will never enter their minds to be remembered. It will not be missed, nor will another one be made." So what about all of these searching for the lost Ark of the Covenant? What happened to it? Well, it's not part of religion anymore, is it? It's not part of... As a matter of fact, why would it disappear? Because Israel wasn't keeping the covenant. Right? Why have an Ark of the Covenant in the first place if they're not going to keep the covenant? And that's Jeremiah in the 31st chapter talks about that. So the Ark of the Covenant, it'll never come to mind and it'll not be missed, and they're not going to make another one. "At that time they will call Jerusalem the throne of the Lord, and all nations will gather in Jerusalem to honor the name of the Lord." When did that happen? Well, the day of Pentecost comes to mind, doesn't it? So he's talking about something else. And in Revelation chapter 11, you read across this and you may not notice it, but seventh angel sounded his trumpet and there were loud voices in heaven which said, "The kingdom of this world has become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he will reign forever and ever and ever." Where did we get that? Handel's Messiah uses that very set of words, doesn't it, in the song. And so when did that happen? At the resurrection of Jesus, didn't it? Then God's temple in heaven was opened. Was the temple on earth opened at that point when Jesus was crucified and resurrected? Yeah, the veil in the temple, Paul, whoever wrote Hebrews, talks about the fact that it was opened and available, and Jesus went in and offered his own blood. And so God's temple in heaven was opened, and within his temple was seen the Ark of the Covenant. What's it doing in heaven? I suspect God took it back, didn't he? He took it to heaven. And we'll get to Ezekiel, and we got about 15 minutes, and we can see what Ezekiel has to say about that. "Seventh day of the fifth month in the 19th year, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, Nebuzaradan, commander of the imperial guard, an official of the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem. He set fire to the temple of the Lord, the royal palace, and all the houses of Jerusalem. Every important building he burned down." This is the destruction of Jerusalem. "The whole Babylonian army, under the commander of the imperial guard, broke down the walls around Jerusalem." So, here we have some things that Ezekiel has to say about all of this. Now, Ezekiel was a prophet at the time of the Babylonian captivity. And he was carried away, like many of the refugees, into Babylon. And they keep hoping they're going to get to go back to Jerusalem someday. And God sends him to them as a prophet in this period of time. And he speaks sometimes to the people in Babylonia or in Persia somewhere. And at other times, God carries him back to Jerusalem to see what happened before the temple was destroyed and what's going to happen afterwards. And that's what this section of the Bible is about. We're not going to spend a lot of time. You read Ezekiel and you get a lot of strange images there, and it takes a while to puzzle all of that out. But he talks about cherubim. Now, they were involved, you remember, golden models of cherubim in the temple. But these are the real things. The cherubim were standing on the south side of the temple, and this is before it was destroyed. When the man went in, the man here is an angel, and a cloud filled the inner court. Then the glory of the Lord rose from above the cherubim. It had been riding on the cherubim, and it moved to the threshold of the temple. The cloud filled the temple, and the court was full of the radiance of the glory of the Lord. That sounds like what happened back in the time of Solomon. The sound of the wings of the cherubim could be heard as far away as the outer court, like the voice of God Almighty when he speaks. So there's a loud noise. Some people have suggested maybe this is a helicopter of some sort. They'd make a loud noise. But it's what God has chosen to appear on this site at this time. And it's a vision that Ezekiel's seeing, okay? It's not something Ezekiel's carried back in time to see this happen. Then the glory of the Lord departed from over. Now this is later on in chapter 10. The glory of the Lord departed from over the threshold of the temple and stopped above the cherubim. He goes back and he gets in his conveyance. While I watched, the cherubim spread their wings and rose from the ground, and as they went, the wheels went with them. They stopped at the entrance to the east gate of the Lord's house, and the glory of the God of Israel was above them. And the glory of God is leaving the temple before it's destroyed in this story. In chapter 11, toward the end, then the cherubim with the wheels beside them spread their wings, and the glory of God of Israel was the glory of the God of Israel, not if, was above them. The glory of the Lord went up from within the city and stopped above the mountain east of it. The Spirit lifted me up and brought me to the exiles in Babylonia in the vision given by the Spirit of God. And so he gets to witness the glory of God leaving at the time. And it's interesting in that whole series in the 10th, 11th chapter, it's God's will to burn down the city. He has them scatter coals of fire over the whole city of Jerusalem. Although we read that it was the guard of the Babylonians who did it, it's God's will that Jerusalem be destroyed. It wasn't something that they could do without God's permission. Now we go over to chapter 40, in the 25th year of our exile. How long are they going to be in exile? Jeremiah told them, 70 years, isn't it? And it's going to be longer than that before many of them get back to Jerusalem. So, at the beginning of the year, on the 10th of the month, in the 14th year after the fall of the city, and so we know exactly what year that was, the fall of the city. Well, the city was taken over by the Babylonians in 606 B.C., and in 587 it was destroyed. On that very day, the hand of the Lord was upon me, and he took me there, in visions of God. He took me to the land of Israel and set me on a very high mountain on whose south side was some buildings that looked like a city. So it's kind of dreamlike here. He sees out and where he's been taken is to Jerusalem, and the city's going to be rebuilt is what this is telling him. He took me there and I saw a man whose appearance was like bronze. When you see a man who looks like he's made out of bronze, that's always an angel. He was standing in the gateway with a linen cord and a measuring rod in his hand. And so the 41st and 42nd, or the 41st chapter of Ezekiel particularly, I ask you to read that. That's all of the dimensions of a new temple that they'll rebuild when the Jews come back to Jerusalem. I saw a wall completely surrounding the temple area. The length of the measuring rod in the man's hand was 6 long cubits, each of which was a cubit and a hand's breadth. You see, here's again this cubit according to the old standard. This is Moses' cubit, which is the distance from the tip of the elbow to the tip of the finger. That's thought to be what this cubit was based on. That, in most people, is about 18 inches. But it's got a hand breadth on top of that to make it a long cubit. And so that's consistent with Solomon using a cubit of the old standard. The temple was always built on a longer cubit than the one used by the population. He measured the wall. It was one measuring rod thick, one rod high, so it was 6 cubits in each direction. And so we'll skip through all of the details of that, but it describes a temple like this. Does that look familiar? It's exactly like Solomon's temple. Well, there may be some differences in the porch, but and the altar's put on the south side instead of the north side. But it's got side rooms. It's got an inner sanctuary, outer sanctuary. What are they going to put in the inner sanctuary? No altar, no Ark of the Covenant. In fact, there aren't any cherubim anymore. That room's going to stand empty. From then on, and in Herod's temple, it's also empty. It may have an altar of incense in it that they moved into it when they filled it with smoke. And the other interesting thing about it is that this, well, we'll see, the exiles come back and they build a temple. The man brought me to the gate facing east, and I saw the glory of the God of Israel coming from the east. His voice was like the roar of rushing waters. The land was radiant with his glory. The vision I saw was like the vision I had seen when he came to destroy the city, and like the visions I had seen by the Kibar River. And I fell face downward. The glory of the Lord entered the temple through the gate facing east. Now this is the new temple, you see. Then the Spirit lifted me up and brought me into the inner court, and the glory of the Lord filled the temple. Now in chapter 43, God tells Ezekiel, Son of man, describe the temple to the people of Israel that they may be ashamed of their sins. Let them consider the plan, and if they are ashamed of all they have done, make known to them the design of the temple, its arrangement, its exits and entrances, its whole design and all its regulations and laws. Write these down before them so that they may be faithful to its design and follow all its regulations. So when they rebuild the temple, what design are they going to use? I think they're going to use Ezekiel's design. Now, some people say that this temple was never built again, but it's the same temple. And interestingly, it's the design that God gave to David. And if he's going to give one to Ezekiel, I think he's going to be consistent in the plan that he has for his temple. This is the law of the temple. We'll talk about this in just a minute. All the surrounding area on top of the mountain will be most holy. Such is the law of the temple. Is that an interesting law? What does it mean for all the area around the temple to be holy? What makes it holy? Think about that for a minute. We'll talk about that again. So the elders of the Jews continued to build and prosper under the preaching of Haggai the prophet. This is Ezra 6. And Zechariah, a descendant of Iddo. They finished building the temple according to the command of the God of Israel and the decrees of Cyrus, Darius, and Artaxerxes, kings of Persia. Remember, Ezra starts out with the decree of Cyrus to go back and rebuild the temple. The temple was completed in the third day of the month of Adar, the sixth year of the reign of King Darius. Then the people of Israel, the priests, the Levites, and the rest of the exiles celebrated the dedication of the house of God with joy. It wasn't covered with gold like Solomon's, but it's the same design and the same basic plan. So, think about, and we're going to talk about this in 2 weeks again. Think about what happened in Acts, the second chapter. Okay? I'll read this part to you. When the day of Pentecost came, it's a familiar verse. We've all memorized it. They were all together in one place. Suddenly a sound like the blowing of a violent wind came from heaven and filled the whole house where they were sitting. They saw what seemed to be tongues of fire that separated and came to rest on each of them. What are those tongues of fire? Why did they separate and rest on individuals? I submit to you that I think that's the glory of God returning to the temple. But where is the temple? It's within us, isn't it? And so the the tongues of fire sat, I don't know if it sat on the ear or the nose or the top of the head, and it came inside the temple. God returned to his temple. He never returned to Herod's temple. He never, as far as the record is concerned anyway, but he came to the temple that he intended all along. And all of this story about the tabernacle and the temple prepares us to understand that he wants to dwell within us, not in some structure we built, not this church building, but within the people. Okay? That the law of the temple, in just a minute, law of the temple is that all of the surrounding area should be what? Holy. And so God will dwell in your temple if the area around, what does that mean? That means the rest of your life, I think. You can't just say, I'll prepare my heart to receive God. You have to prepare your life to receive God into your temple, which is up here somewhere, or where is your heart? It's associated, I think, with your mind. Okay, Bob? I think so. He's saying that Jeremiah 31:31, where God says he will write his laws upon their heart. Yeah. And I think that's right, that the laws of God and the covenant that he makes with us dwells within our heart. And it's not something on stones in a box. Those represent symbols of something that was due to come someday. But it's all, even what Ken was telling us this morning, God wants to build a relationship with individuals. He's not interested in an organization and some sort of a community effort. He wants individuals to be involved in the temple. And you are the temple of God. It's kind of scary, isn't it? Okay. Judy? Yeah, what about them? Yeah. That's not a temple. Yeah, their synagogue is sort of like a Bible classroom. But they don't understand. I think that's what about the Jews of today. They don't have a temple. They want to build one, but the site belongs to the Arabs now, you see. So there's going to be a war before there can be a temple built there. And I don't think it'll ever happen, but I could be wrong. They may be stubborn enough to bring it about somehow. But it's not a building anymore. The temple is within us. Okay, our time's gone. Next week, we'll talk about the temple that Herod built.